Hi, this is Jane Garvey, and thank you for downloading the Woman's Hour podcast from Monday, the 8th of January, 2018. Now, on this edition of the podcast, Carrie Gracie tells us why she's resigned as the BBC's China editor over the issue of equal pay. We'll discuss extended parental leave for people who have premature babies, and there was a black night last night at the Golden Globes, so we talk clothes as protest on Woman's Hour today. First, though, you might well know that the Justice Department is reviewing the way parole works after that decision to release John Warboys, the man who spent 9 years in prison for a series of sexual assaults. The Justice Secretary is likely to face some questions in the Commons about this today. Over the weekend, there were calls for the police to investigate more cases. And yesterday, the Prime Minister said she personally knew one of Warboys' victims and that that person didn't know about his release until she heard it on the news. We have been contacted by another woman who says she was attacked by Warboys when she was just 18.
I've been out for a works party around the west end of London in Great Portland Street, and I'd missed the last tube home, so I'd called my boyfriend at the time from the phone box to say I wasn't sure how to get home and was a bit drunk, and so he decided to come up and meet me. But when he got there, I wasn't there any longer. And I don't remember getting into the taxi, but I suddenly was in a taxi. And I remember the taxi driver being really chatty and asking me lots about myself. I was a student doing an arts degree, and he was really interested in my paintings and telling me how he life modelled and would love to see my paintings. And I remember talking about photography and stuff. I don't really remember him giving me a drink or anything, but the next thing I do remember is him parking the taxi in the car park in Regent's Park by London Zoo and clambering in the back with me to take photos of me, and him talking about a blowjob and everything going really hazy after that, and not remembering anything else until waking up in my bed in my flat the next morning, still wearing the same clothes and my makeup and having wet myself, a total blackout of what had happened. Which in hindsight, I think must be related to having been drugged or something. And the next thing I know, our telephone goes and it's my boyfriend telling me I need to go to work. And I feel absolutely mortified because I was late for work. So I ran to work, did my shift in the same clothes and makeup, and got home to find my boyfriend quite angry because he'd been looking all around Oxford Street for me that night. And it was only then that I began to sort of remember what had happened and tell him what happened. And after that, I sort of started getting panic attacks whenever I heard the noise of a taxi and flashbacks and so forth. And then I got a phone call from this guy saying that he was a taxi driver and he really enjoyed the other night and could we do it again? I don't remember giving him my telephone number or anything.
And this was in the days before mobile phones, so he called you where?
On my landline. So he knew my address because he'd taken me home, so I don't know how he got my number, whether I had given it to him. Or he'd looked it up because we were in the phone book.
When did you involve the police?
So that happened in 2000. I saw the story in the press in 2008, and that's when I involved the police. It's before it had gone to trial. I went to the Met Police, and I was given a rape support officer came out and spoke to me, and she took my statement. My statement got sent to the team who were investigating Warboys, and they confirmed that they felt from my statement that it would have been him. I recognised his face in the pictures as well, although I remember him being a bit thinner in the face.
But tellingly, this all happened to you 2 years before officially Warboys started behaving in this way.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the things that I feel quite guilty about, but also very wary about the fact that I feel this man had been doing this for a lot longer than is suspected.
Well, you shouldn't feel guilty about anything, of course, we should say. But what happened then to your case?
I was told that the police were grateful for my statement and for me coming forward. However, they weren't going to use it in the prosecution case because they had 12 very strong cases that they were going to use. I was then the female officer left the case, and I was given a male officer, and he advised me to go to EVES, who were a women's support charity at the time, and they were able to support me through a counselling scheme that they ran. I heard nothing further.
Nothing further to do with the police in this case?
Yes.
How would you describe their approach to you, to what happened to you?
So the female police officer, she was incredibly supportive, and she used to call me and keep me informed. When it changed to the other officer, he was a bit dismissive, and that was it, really. I was just sort of told to go off to a charity. And then, as I've heard, nothing since. My mobile and my email address have not changed since I gave the statement, so they would have been able to contact me. The first I heard about War Boys being released was from the radio.
And how did you react to that?
I just felt so angry, really, really angry. I feel this man is a fantasist, and he littered evidence. He was keeping notebooks. He took photographs. He kept things from the women. The police suspect that there are far more than the 80 people who came forward. Why do they suspect that? Probably because in the notebooks there are far more attacks and details of assaults that he did than the 80 that they know about. So I can't see how in 10 years he has been able to be reformed. There were so many attacks that 10 years is not enough, that there needs to be a second prosecution.
Your point then would be that had the police pursued more cases, then in fact War Boys wouldn't be on the point of release. It would be quite preposterous. He'd probably have been serving a genuine life sentence and never got out.
Yes, sure. And I know that at the time he's given an indeterminate sentence, and that was one of the reasons that they'd said to me they weren't going to take any further statements, because they felt indeterminate meant life anyhow.
Where does all this leave you?
It just leaves me feeling angry, but also I feel that I want to get out there and do something to help women like me. I mean, I'm a lot older now. I feel that I probably would have reported it if it happened to me today. But I would like to try and support women who do feel vulnerable and who may feel that they were to blame because they've been out drinking, or because they can't quite remember what happened. They're not to blame. That they should come forward, because this man set out to do this. He was targeting them. He's an abuser. He set out to do this. And that, in my mind, makes him absolutely guilty.
You sound really determined, but I do wonder about the long-term impact on you. Could you sum that up?
I've been really lucky. So Eves were very supportive. I was set up in a scheme where I was able to talk to another woman who'd experienced sexual abuse, and we met regularly. So I was able to talk it through with her what had happened to me. And I had counselling through the NHS. So I feel very, very strong. I don't feel particularly vulnerable about this any longer.
Well, we're very grateful to that brave woman for being prepared to come on to the programme to talk about this. A statement from the police. They say, "We work closely with the CPS throughout the case of War Boys. Liaison with the CPS continued post-trial when the Met had allegations from 19 other women. Each one was recorded and investigated. In June 2009, the CPS were notified of the additional complaints and provided written advice in response. Each allegation was assessed by police against this advice, and the decision was taken not to proceed. All 19 complainants were notified. As no new information has been received at this time, there is currently no live Met investigation. Should any more information come to light, that information will be fully investigated." So that is the Met statement this morning. Heather Harvey works for a charity called NIA, which helps women and children who are victims of violence. Heather, welcome to the programme. Interestingly, you used to work for Eves.
Yes, funnily enough.
Yeah, well, the organisation that the woman we've just heard from mentioned doesn't exist anymore.
No.
Who helps women like her now?
Well, Eves used to support around 2,000 women, so obviously it leaves a big hole, but there are still specialist organisations out there, in particular organisations like Rape Crisis. But yes, it leaves a massive hole. And I think the thing I just wanted to say about that particular project, the scheme that the young woman is talking about, was called the Amina Scheme. And it was a very specialist scheme. And the thing that made it so effective was that it was directly tailored to the individual women. But that makes it appear quite expensive to run. And when you're looking at a commissioning framework that is looking for the lowest unit cost and for mass economies of scale, it's really difficult. So that does leave a gap. But there are still some services out there,
right,
but never enough.
I know, when in fact you've been there helping out this weekend on the Rape Crisis Helpline. Mm-hmm. When stories like that of War Boys comes to huge publicity and everyone's aware of it and talking about it, what happens in terms of calls to the helpline?
Well, what we generally see in rape crisis is if there is any kind of media coverage of child sexual abuse, sexual assault, rape of any sort, there is often an increase in the number of calls to the helpline. It might not be specific to that individual case, but it will be about people being triggered or thinking, actually, I need some help for this because I've experienced this. It's difficult to say at this moment, though, because we've had sexual violence and sexual harassment in the news for so long. I mean, it must be 6-8 months that we've had an almost constant stream of stories. Sure. So it's difficult to single out one particular thing at the moment.
Right. In fact, we're going on to talk about the Golden Globes last night and the clothing protests and all the rest of it. Really importantly, there is going to be a ruling from the Supreme Court in the relatively near future. Just explain the significance of that.
So this is actually a really, really significant judgment. Two women, one was raped by war boys in 2003 and another in 2007. And they argued that had the police investigated their case properly, because they didn't, the police didn't take it seriously, there were lots of failings, they didn't follow their own guidelines. Had they investigated it properly, they were arguing it may be that war boys could have been caught a lot sooner. And that case, they were successful in that case. They were awarded damages for that case. But actually, the police, supported by the Home Secretary, Theresa May at the time, argued that actually there should be a limit to the level of responsibility of the police in investigating rape cases. And that's been ping-ponging backwards and forwards in the courts since 2003. And it was only in 2017, if you think about that young woman raped in 2003, it was only in March of 2017, we finally ended up in Supreme Court simply trying to argue that the police should investigate cases properly and be held to account if they don't. That judgment we're still waiting for, but it's imminent.
But if that Supreme Court judgment comes out in favour of the police, where would that leave people like the lady we've just heard from?
Well, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens, because actually what we have seen, interestingly, is that a lot of the European judgments are very supportive of the case that the women are making about the extent of the police investigative duty, whereas a lot of the UK case law has been quite hostile to the extent of the law. So it may well be that we have to carry on all the way to Europe, which will be interesting in the current climate, of course.
Heather Harvey, thank you very much for coming on the programme. And of course, details of organisations which can offer information and support with sexual abuse or sexual violence are available via bbc.co.uk/actionline. Or you can call them anytime to hear recorded information. 0800 077 077 is the number there. 0800 077 077. Now, very much in the news this morning, our next contributor, Carrie Gracie, who has, you will have heard, resigned as the BBC's China editor over equal pay. In an open letter issued yesterday, Carrie, who's worked for the BBC for more than 30 years, said the BBC had a secretive and illegal pay culture. She said there is, or the BBC, I should say, says there is no systemic discrimination against women. So that's the BBC's line. We should make that very clear. Now, because of BBC impartiality rules, I can't interview Carrie. But Jane Martinson is a freelance journalist and a former women's editor and media editor at The Guardian. She's in our radio car this morning and she is going to speak to Carrie Gracie. So, Jane Martinson.
Thanks, Jane. Hello, Carrie. You're one of the most prominent female journalists at the BBC. You've never complained before. Why did you feel that you had to resign as China editor over this issue of pay?
From when the pay revelations were made last July, I have been trying to put it right through negotiation and through internal discussion. I lodged an equal pay complaint in August. On the 1st of August, I wrote to the Director General explaining that and warning that I would resign if I was not paid equally. I've explained to all my managers how important it was to me, the principle of equal pay, and that actually I reminded them that when I went to China, I had actually insisted that it was a condition of my going. So I was very disappointed by the pay revelations in July. I set about trying by negotiation to put that right. In October, the BBC made me a pay offer. My pay, as you may know, is £135,000. The BBC offered to raise that to £180,000. However, I was not interested in more money. I was interested in equality. And I kept saying to my managers that I didn't need more money. I just needed to be made equal. And that can be done in a variety of ways. So that went on, and then eventually when the BBC wouldn't budge on that, I lodged a formal grievance. And I came back in November for the grievance hearing. And at that point, I warned that I would find it very difficult to go back to China again without the issue resolved. The BBC said it hoped to have a grievance outcome before Christmas, but there is still no grievance outcome to this day. And I just decided that enough was enough. For 6 months, this has made me very unhappy. It's been a huge job of work to try to put it right, to understand the law. I set about it like any other reporting task. I tried to understand the law. Mm. I looked at employment tribunal cases. I talked to colleagues, male and female. I talked to my bosses. I talked to lawyers. And at the end of all of that, it's very hard to continue to do what is the job of China editor in one of the, which I do see as one of the most important and most difficult reporting jobs of our time. You know, I chase around being surveilled the whole time and dealing with intimidation, dealing with police harassment. I try and put everyone from yak herders to Communist Party officials on camera in a heavily censored one-party state. I speak Chinese. I have a degree in Chinese. I've been reporting the story for nearly 30 years. Do you know what I mean? I just feel I work hard.
I mean, your open letter shows how absolutely furious you are with the BBC, Carrie, even though you say the organisation is something you still love. What exactly happened to make you so angry? As you say, they offered you £45,000 more, a lot of money for lots of people. What actually went wrong that you felt this breakdown of trust?
I didn't feel that it was a solution. I felt it was a divide and rule botched solution that would not make the BBC better. And I do love the BBC. I've been I've been in the BBC for, as Jane pointed out, more than 30 years. This is my professional family. I want it to be the best. Every day I go out without fear or favour, facing intimidation in China, facing censorship, and actually telling the story and shining a light. I'm not going to not shine a light when I find a problem in my home organisation that needs saying.
What did they actually say to you, Carrie, though? As you say, they did offer you more money. What did they say, and how did it not help?
I didn't want more money, do you understand? I wanted equality, and this was not equality. There was still a big gap between myself and my male peers. And I started... To me, this was an exercise in understanding how the BBC approached pay. And at the end of the exercise, I felt the BBC was not approaching pay in an appropriate way. The pay system was neither equal nor fair, nor was it transparent. And I thought all of that needed to change. And I'm afraid I have, over the past few months, as a result of communications between a lot of BBC women who have been similarly shocked, not just by their own experience, but by sharing their experiences and understanding the experiences of each other. I felt when I perceived that some of the patterns of the way I was being treated were also appearing in so many cases, I felt that there was a lack of seriousness.
Carrie, do you think that they should cut, men should have a pay cut to make it equal? Because it's, as you say, it's equality here. You weren't asking for more money. You don't want more money. You were asking for equality. What can the BBC do?
Well, I believe in public service broadcasting. And I do think, as you will have seen from my letter, I do think salaries at the top are unacceptably high, both for presenters and stars of various kinds, and also for managers, actually. But I don't have the information, Jane, to say, oh, well, this needs to happen or that needs to happen. And none of the BBC women have that information. I do stand by what I say about the BBC being a secretive organisation on pay, and I think it's very inappropriate. The people in the BBC, the women in the BBC, who know that they're not being discriminated against on pay, are those in senior management whose pay is published. The rest of us are in a situation where we literally don't have the information to understand whether the BBC is applying the law in our case.
Let me read the statement from the BBC here, Carrie. Fairness in pay is vital, says a spokesman. A significant number of organisations have now published their gender pay figures, showing that we are performing considerably better than many and are well below the national average. Alongside that, we have already conducted an independent judge-led audit of pay for rank and file staff, which showed no systemic discrimination against women. A separate report for on-air staff will be published in the not-too-distant future. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I also believe in fair pay. I strongly believe in fair pay. I think the BBC's pay system needs to be equal, gender equal, and equal in many other ways. And I also think it needs to be fair. I work with incredibly talented and dedicated people every day of my working life. People who are earning much less than me. And I think the disparities in pay at the BBC, they make me uncomfortable, some of them, as a, you know, as somebody who believes in public service broadcasting. So I would thoroughly endorse a pay structure which was fair. But I don't believe the current pay structure is fair
or
equal or transparent. And I want to just finish my answer to the question you first asked me, Jane. You asked me why now. And the answer is, given that the grievance hadn't reported back, I could not go back to China and collude knowingly in what I consider to be unlawful pay discrimination. I could not do it, nor could I stay silent and watch the BBC perpetuate a failing pay structure by discriminating against women. I can't do it.
What happens next, Carrie? Is there legal action against the BBC? There are 200 women who've lodged grievances. What happens next?
I don't know. I mean, there are many of us and we have different positions. I think that I would like to see the BBC treat these BBC women with respect. I mean, we are all very, in my experience, very committed to the BBC. We want the best for the BBC. And the sooner the BBC deals with this problem and puts in place a better structure for the future, the sooner that some women, perhaps many, perhaps most, I don't know, will be prepared to forgive some of the problems of the past.
Should anyone resign over this, Carrie? You say it's problems of the past. Is there any existing management at the BBC who should be held responsible for this, do you think?
I think it's a system and a culture. And I said in my letter, and I say again, that I have been grateful to individual managers for their kindness to me in difficult situations in my life or in my work. And I've also been grateful for their strong stand, their robust editorial integrity when it came to situations where the Chinese government was putting pressure on me and putting pressure on the BBC back here in London. Now, having said that, I really would like to see a seriousness in the approach to this problem.
There are many more questions we'd love to ask you, but I'm afraid we're running out of time now. Thank you. We have to go back to Jane now.
That was Jane Martinson, who is a former women's editor and media editor at The Guardian. And she was interviewing the BBC's former China editor, Carrie Gracie, who has resigned, as you'll know, over the issue of equal pay. Thanks to everybody who's been tweeting about this. Just a brief mention to Sarah, who says this is a public story of what happens to lots of us being told now on Woman's Hour by Carrie Gracie. This lack of equality needs to end. Good for her for standing up to be heard and refusing to back down. Many of us are silenced by compromise or settlement agreements and plain battle fatigue. Well, I think Carrie probably does feel quite tired, but we are very grateful to her. Thank you very much, Carrie.
Thank you.
Now, impartiality does not stop me discussing the menopause on Woman's Hour next week. I can't think why it doesn't, because really I'm not impartial on that either. Anyway, we're discussing the menopause next week. A whole series across the week looking at the impact the menopause has on women's lives, particularly actually on working lives. And on Monday, next Monday, we've got a phone-in programme where you can share your own experiences of the menopause. And on Tuesday, we have new data from a poll commissioned by us and BBC Radio Sheffield, which I think you'll find very, very interesting. So that's next week on the programme. Now, to events last night in Hollywood, the black dresses at the Golden Globes, that form of protest. So in the past, of course, we've often used clothes to protest. Throughout history, it's been done. Does it matter? What kind of message does it send? Let's talk to Professor Francis Corner, who's the head of London College of Fashion and pro-vice-chancellor at the University of the Arts. She's the author of a book called Why Fashion Matters. Francis, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So what did you make of what happened at the Golden Globes last night?
I think it was, again, a really important statement. I know a lot of there's a lot of criticism at times about, you know, why wasn't this done before? Why didn't more women and men call out some of the situations much earlier? But I feel, as we've been hearing this morning, all industries are faced with inequality, abuse, exploitation, inequality. And the great thing about the Wearing Black was that it was a very visual representation of a whole range of arguments that are very much in the news right now.
It was striking. It was clearly effective. We are talking about it. The images are everywhere. However, some people are saying, look, if these people, women, felt this strongly, why not just stay at home?
But again, that's silencing women. I find that really difficult because in the end, a lot of this abuse has been perpetrated by men. So why didn't the men stay at home? And then maybe the women could have, you know, come out and worn whatever colours they wished to. I think from a fashion perspective, it's quite interesting because black is a colour which I think encourages reflection and thought. You know, obviously it's used, you know, in religious orders, you know, magisterial, funereal sort of aspects.
And of course, like many people in fashion, you are dressed entirely in black, and I gather you always pretty much are.
I am. And again, that's one of the ways of me sort of making, you know, a statement. I don't want to be seen too much as a peacock. I think that fashion is incredibly important. I celebrate other people wearing lots of colour, but I enjoy the fact that I want it to be taken seriously. And I think fashion has a huge amount to contribute socially, politically, economically, and protest is one of those.
I can remember certainly back in the 80s, the Catherine Hamnett slogan T-shirts, and actually that they've made a comeback, haven't they, recently?
They have. And I think, interestingly enough, the T-shirts that obviously been being picked up by the new creative director, Mary Durer at Dior, and a number of the people last night were wearing Dior, which I thought was really interesting because, again, you've got a new female creative director there. The clothes that were being displayed were very beautiful, very elegant. And, you know, people like Natalie Portman were wearing them. And obviously she made the comment about the fact that, you know, all the directors were men. But having said that, I think there have been some really good statements made at the Globe and Goals, not least by Oprah and so on. So there was more protest than the clothes that was actually going on.
It was hugely effective. And I don't particularly want to criticise them because I think it has worked. Nevertheless, these people are wealthy. They're all styled within an inch of their lives by designers who are getting lots of publicity and attention. You can understand the cynicism, can't you?
Yes, I think it's true, but I think it's also easy to knock. Which I am doing.
Yes, so let's move on.
And I think the thing for me is the protest aspect that I'm interested in.
Also, of course, fast fashion and the price that people in developing countries pay for that, for our lust for new stuff. That's a worry, isn't it?
It is. And again, there's a big move against that. I mean, you look at, say, protests around, say, fashion revolution. Now, that was started in 2013 as part of the anniversary for the Rana Plaza disaster. And a lot of our students have been involved with this, which was, and again, it's a worldwide campaign where people were encouraged to wear their clothes inside out to say, you know, who made my clothes? And the hashtag who made my clothes or even who grew my clothes has become one of those sort of protests that have been very important to highlight the issue of modern slavery.
Well, that fire in Bangladesh was truly hideous. The deaths were, I mean, it was vast, a vast fire.
It was a vast fire. And I think, again, you know, that hasn't stopped. Again, there are still a whole range of issues that are continuing with regards to, you know, exploitation of workers. Of the 57 million garment workers worldwide, 80% of those are female, and we have to keep on it. And at the college, that is something that we're very committed to. A lot of our students are very committed to. And I think what I think is good about the Golden Globes is that if the people become interested in the intellectual debates and the issues behind some of these protests, that's where we can start to bring about real change from the industry.
Right. And of course, the suffragettes wore, in this country, they're very distinctive purple and green.
Yes, that's right.
Americans wore white,
I think they did, that's right. And again, what was interesting there was that a lot of suffragettes were determined to dress very elegantly because they didn't want to be accused of not, in a way, following those norms as opposed to the other ones that they were challenging.
Yes. well, we're still fighting some of these battles,
we certainly are.
As we've illustrated this morning. Thank you very much indeed for being with us this morning. Appreciate it. Professor Frances Corner, head of London College of Fashion, and of course, dressed all in black. Now, it's thought around 60,000 babies are born prematurely in the UK every year. And at the moment, there's no extra entitlement to additional maternity leave or pay. Now, Waltham Forest Council in London has introduced a policy of offering extra maternity and paternity leave to all staff who become parents of premature babies, covering the period of time their baby spends in hospital. This is a rare moment where we can be nice to some guests on the programme from a political bent. And one of them is Councillor Clyde Lokes. Welcome, Clyde. Good to see you. Good morning. Deputy Leader of Waltham Forest, and Sarah Miles is here, Trustee of the charity The Smallest Things. Welcome to you, Sarah. So, Clyde, just tell us exactly then what you have changed.
Well, I attended a meeting last autumn between the union side and leaders of London councils where The Smallest Things campaign and the private members bill from MP Steve Reid was referred to. It wasn't something I was particularly aware of, so I came back to my council where I'm deputy leader. I asked the HR department for a little bit more information, and I just thought, why aren't we doing this?
Right.
We can sit and wait for Parliament to legislate until the cows come home at the moment.
Yes, and we should say that bill has fallen by the wayside, as bills can.
But I thought we could do something on this. It would make a massive difference to our staff that are impacted by having to, you know, use up their statutory and legal maternity and paternity rights before the baby comes home.
So what exactly are you offering?
So we're going to be offering full pay and leave, maternity and paternity leave entitlement for all the weeks before the due date where unfortunately the baby may still be in hospital.
And it must be, we're about to talk to Sarah, who knows much more about this, but it must be a colossal load for any individual to bear, the financial side of this. You haven't got headspace for it, have you, at the time?
It's a very emotional time. I saw Sarah allude to this. Very emotional, stressful time. And we just want to take that, just give that extra bit of comfort, let a little bit of extra stress out of what is a very difficult time for both fathers and mothers.
Yeah, Sarah, tell me a little bit about why you feel so strongly and about how you got involved with this charity.
I got involved with The Smallest Things after I had premature twins in 2011. They were born 12 weeks early. And I was really shocked to find out that my maternity leave started the day after I gave birth. One of my twins spent 3 months in neonatal unit and the other 6 months. And that just... it felt very, very unfair that that counted as maternity leave, because it really wasn't. Sitting by an incubator, hearing those alarms going off, watching babies being resuscitated, watching babies die in intensive care, and just willing your baby to survive and make it through. It's very hard to describe a neonatal unit, but it's just a place of fear and desperate, desperate hope. And for that to count as maternity leave just isn't fair. So I got involved with The Smallest Things when I found out about the campaign to extend maternity leave. And I've been working with them ever since. We've got a petition that is now on 141,000 signatures, which we took to government. And also, as we just heard, Steve Reid took a bill to Parliament, which unfortunately the second reading was cancelled.
Nevertheless, to be fair to him, it got the subject into the spotlight.
Absolutely,
I think
no.
We talked about it too.
Fantastic.
So it doesn't do any harm.
Yes.
But I wonder about your own situation. What about your own employer at the time all this was happening?
So unfortunately, my employer wasn't flexible. So a couple of months after I was home from neonatal unit, or I was back from the neonatal unit, I was asked whether or not I was returning to work. And I felt I had no choice but to resign. One of my twins sadly died. The other was at home, very fragile, premature, worries about everything that was going on, worries about her immune system, worries about her development. And I really needed to be there. And we hear from a lot of people at the charity that have the same experience.
To be clear then, you did ask for extra leave.
I did. Asked for an unpaid extra leave and didn't get it.
How did they justify that or attempt to?
They didn't. And to be honest, my head was in a very different place then as it is now.
Of course.
And with hindsight, I feel very manipulated. But at the time, my focus was on my surviving twin, Charlotte, her development and her health. And it's worth pointing out that when babies come home from the neonatal unit, it isn't over. You know, those babies need so much support. They have a lot of hospital medical appointments that you have to take them to. Readmissions are really high. Nearly half of all premature babies who come home from hospital are subsequently readmitted to hospital. So it isn't over when you leave those neonatal doors. And I think for employers to recognise that and do what they can, show some compassion to give that leave, just time. Yeah. Time to bond with your baby, time to focus on their development. You know, mothers of premature babies are more prone to postnatal depression, 40%, 63% have anxiety, and 44% have flashbacks. I had all of those things. I was not ready to go back to work. Yeah.
Well, listening to that is extraordinarily eloquent. I know, Clyde, we can't, as I said at the beginning, I can't get at you because you've done the right thing at Waltham Forest Council. I know you're delighted
yes,
by it, Sarah.
Yes, absolutely.
But it comes at a cost. How are you able to afford this?
Well, the numbers that are impacted within our own workforce will be relatively small.
Of course, that's true of every employer and no one else appears to have done it yet.
But, you know, I simply came away from this meeting thinking, we can actually make a difference here, a small gesture just to give that little bit of extra comfort, that little bit of extra breathing space to mothers and fathers during a tremendously difficult time. And if we all just made that small step, every employer, and we'll be going out now to our contractors and our partners that we work with, trying to encourage them to make some gesture, some voluntary gesture to just make it easier.
We should make that clear, of course. You employ thousands, but some of them are subcontracted by the council to other employers.
We have contracts outside
sure.
of the council.
How responsive are they likely to be, Clyde?
Well, I'm hoping, listening to your show, to the campaign, that they will be responsive. But I'm going to make sure, and the council's going to make sure, that we continue to say to people, back this campaign, do what you can, give these parents that little bit of extra comfort at such an crucially important time.
Thank you so much, Clyde. Brief word from you, Sarah.
Just wanted to say that the ACAS guidelines have changed, which is great. It's a step in the right direction. But the Smallest Things is still pushing for the law to change on this issue.
Well, I'm sure we'll put up links, if we haven't already, on the Woman's Hour website to the Smallest Things. That's bbc.co.uk/Woman's Hour. And how is your little girl now?
She's really good, thank you. Good. She's six and absolutely brilliant.
All right. OK, you're probably quite busy, I'd imagine. But anyway, thank you very much for being here, both of you. Now, announced this morning as fifth on the BBC Music Sound of 2018 shortlist. This is the list that launched careers like the careers of Adele, Ellie Goulding, Florence and the Machine, are this band. They are called Pale Waves. They're from Manchester and they are Heather Baron Gracie and Kira Doran. And here are a couple of tracks. We're going to start with There's a Honey, followed by New Year's Eve. New Year's Eve, before that, There's a Honey, and Pale Waves are with me. Heather and Kira, good morning to you. Great to have you on.
Morning.
I've just made your day by saying I've downloaded New Year's Day.
Yeah.
You both looked horrified, actually, thinking, what's this old woman downloading that for? It's the last thing we need. So tell me a bit about your friendship. How did you meet, Heather? How did you meet?
Yeah, so we met online, I guess, didn't we? Mm-hmm. I saw Kira's picture and then I instantly sort of drew to her because of her fashion sense.
What was it about her fashion sense?
Well, you know, when you just see some people and you're like...
Kindred spirit.
They just don't really care what... you know, they don't follow anyone's sort of rules. So I guess I was instantly drawn to her and then we just never spent a day apart after we met up.
Oh, is that right, Kira?
Yeah, only on Christmas we don't spend
Yeah, all right.
Together.
Well, we don't need every single detail of what you did over Christmas. You're heavily 80s influenced, aren't
yeah.
you? Tell me about some of the artists and the bands that you both really love from the 80s.
We love The Cure.
Right.
One of our favourite bands.
The Blue Nile, we listen to a lot of them.
Yeah, I've got the Blue Nile. What's that album? Night Lights, City Lights?
That's our Pats, isn't it?
Downtown.
Yeah, Downtown.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, they are brilliant, but they are moody and quite dark.
Yeah.
Where's the... have you got any light and shade about you, or are you both... because those two tracks sounded pretty perky to me.
I guess, like, within, like, my songwriting, usually I write quite dark stuff, and that sort of, like, the music sort of balances it out, because that's quite uplifting.
Yeah, so it's like A nice sort of contrast. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's you two in the band. There are others in the band, Kira?
Yeah, two boys.
Right. And what do they do? Because you play the drums, Kira.
Yeah.
What do they do?
Guitar and bass.
Right. I know I don't want to focus on the fact that you play the drums, but I suppose it is still relatively unusual, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
It is. Well, you get a lot of girls coming up to you at our shows, don't you, saying, like, you know, Kira's really inspired them to start playing drums. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
And it's important, I think, to emphasise this is your band with boys in it, not the other way around.
No.
Is that
yeah, it's
something you feel strongly about, Kira, though, making that clear to people?
No, because we love them as
well. Yeah, it's their band as much as it is ours. But I guess, like, we started the band together. We're, like, the sort of dominant writers within the band.
Yeah.
The face of the band, really. So but we're all sort of, like, really close, best friends.
This whole business, this BBC list, it really has. I mean, I've read out some of the names that were on it, have been on it in the past. This is big, big stuff.
Yeah,
isn't
we're
it?
Really excited about
so,
it.
So, well, Kira, how are you going to make the most of it? How are you going to use this?
I don't know. I guess,
just being a part of it is just
It's really
something
cool.
Massive within that, like, itself, being on that list with so many great artists.
Yeah, we're really honoured to be picked for it, really.
Heather and Kira from Pale Waves, who I think have got a glittering future ahead of them, but to my absolute shock, they'd never heard of Teardrop Explodes. I've put them right, and I'm very hopeful that they're going to get into Teardrop Explodes in the next couple of weeks. Well, I told them, I ordered them to get into them immediately, because they are massive fans of 80s music, as they illustrated in that conversation. Now, lots of reaction from you today, not least to the interview with Carrie Gracie, the BBC's now former China editor, who has, of course, resigned over the issue of equal pay. They've even been pitching in over at ITV, and Julie Etchingham, who is a notable ITV newsreader, tweeted to say, BBC Carrie being interviewed by Jane Martinson, who's in a radio car, because BBC guidelines say Jane Garvey on Woman's Hour can't. Extraordinary listen. Well, that is BBC impartiality for you. So, no, I couldn't do that interview. But it's much more important, I think, that Carrie Gracie gets on the programme. This email from a listener who says, I get where Carrie Gracie is coming from, re the inequality of pay, exorbitant amounts paid to some BBC staff. However, I am somewhat confused about her stance, re the BBC, as she was on the Today programme this morning, and indeed quite a few of those programmes during recent weeks. If she wants to make a stance, and a much publicised one at that, she should resign from the BBC entirely. That's one point made by a listener. This from Linda. Equal pay in professions, teaching, medical, nursing, etc. There should be a pay scale in the BBC as well. From Judith Bravo, BBC Carrie, and all those BBC staff supporting her decision. This surely is indicative of what's happening in other institutions with even less transparency. From Tom, a courageous act, the type of woman I hope inspires my brave, clever and fire-bellied three-year-old daughter in the future. From Christine, glad BBC's China editor feels able to carry through her principles and resign from her 135 grand a year job. I'm a retired teacher earning around 32k when I left the profession. Two friends still in teaching in the last few weeks have seen redundancies in their schools, 40 members of staff in one case. These are largely women, many of them on very low salaries, who could not afford to give up their jobs on principle. A major blow for them, and also for those left behind, expected to pick up the slack. I sympathise and am inspired by Carrie Gracie's stand, but she lives in another world from most of us. There are much more critical pay and employment issues to be addressed. From Catherine, Carrie Gracie, one of the most interesting, informative and trusted journalists of our time in one of the most complex and important countries in the world, China. As a woman of 63, I now see no reason why I should pay more than half the licence fee, as I am not represented in an equal way by the BBC. Generally, nothing will be achieved until men are given equal paternity leave with women, something that my son would have loved as a father of two daughters, but could afford no more than 2 weeks. When employers see women and men as equal opportunities in their business and equal risks, then they will have no reason to discriminate. Let's talk about the gold, safer territory with the Golden Globes. Linda, people still making comments about women wearing glamorous dresses. Not understanding sex abuse is about power, not about what women wear. Ian, if they really wanted to protest, why didn't they all wear tracksuits and no makeup? John, if the women reject being the object of Hollywood sexual malpractice, why not all attend the ceremony wearing beige boiler suits rather than fashionable black numbers? Now, that would be a statement. And to the issue of premature births, Cass says, this is a tweet, I was off for 3 months. My tiny baby was 2 months premature. I got 1 month of standard motherhood and it took ages for me to feel like a mother. Yeah, that's a good point. And I haven't been through that experience. It does. Sarah, I thought, was just brilliant at explaining just how difficult it was when your baby was born prematurely. I thought she was amazing. From Georgina on the same subject, such support in very tough times would definitely reduce financial stress. And Mary, listening to Woman's Hour about maternity leave and premature babies. Great campaign, this. Many premature babies are surprise arrivals and unplanned, adding to the worry and the financial burden. And the alarms in the unit stay with you forever. Mary, I'm sure they do. And I hope things are going well for you now. Thank you very much for taking part. And thanks to everybody who has interacted with Woman's Hour this morning. Not a very usual edition of the programme, but I hope you enjoyed it. And the programme and the podcast back tomorrow, when, amongst other things, we're talking about death cleaning. Now, death cleaning is when you sort out your house, hopefully. Well, you have to do it before you die, because even I know you can't do it after you're not there anymore. But death cleaning is something few of us want to face, but we all should. So that's the subject for Woman's Hour, the programme and the podcast tomorrow.
Are you kidding? You here? I'm Sindhu V. Yeah. And I'm a fan of Women's Hour too. You know what else I'm a fan of? Comedy. What? You too? Well, do I have just the thing for you. Subscribe to Radio 4's Comedy of the Week, wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll meet there as well. Woohoo! Every week, we'll talk funny, as in ha-ha funny. I'll bring you shows from Radio 4's cornucopia. Oh, love that word. Cornucopia of comedy. I'll interview writer and performer peeps. And I will deliver all of this right into your eardrums. So please, hurry up and come meet me at Comedy of the Week.